Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. A couple months ago, Guy McPherson discussed how we should act now that we're doomed to extinction soon because of global warming. Maybe that's begging the question a little, but this week he reviews the science behind our climate catastrophe. Well, that settles that. I hope you'll stay tuned. In May 2014, two of our shows broadcast an interview with biologist and ecologist Guy McPherson. It was about what should we do now that the human species is doomed to extinction within 50 years because of climate change. It was a nice discussion of cultural trends and the hollowness of our so-called leaders and the hollowness of our institutions and the tyranny of the capitalist system, and so on. McPherson sounded a lot like Chris Hedges, only more resigned and less angry. I liked the interview a lot, but it did kind of beg the question, are we doomed to extinction by mid-century? Well, the interview came right after a speech McPherson gave in Winnipeg. Unfortunately, we missed the speech. We will now correct that oversight. A recording of the speech has been obtained, and if the gods permit, we shall hear it this week and next. Here McPherson summarizes the science that explains our global catastrophe. The Earth is getting warmer, and it's getting warmer at a faster and faster rate. Global warming is now probably out of control and irreversible. The key term is self-reinforcing positive feedback loop. And McPherson says there are at least 28 of these. Here's one example. Warmer climate melts the permafrost. This releases methane. Methane is an extremely potent greenhouse gas, so that makes it get warmer still, which melts more permafrost, releasing much more methane, which makes it get warmer still. And on and on. It just snowballs out of control. And yes, snowball is one really bad choice of metaphor. I know that. Don't forget, I'm an English major. In Winnipeg, February 6, 2014, explaining the science behind the catastrophe that is now well underway, here is Professor Guy McPherson.
It appears that we've gone down a path that leads us to human extinction in the not-too-distant future. We've had no humans on Earth at 3.5 degrees above baseline. We are headed for more than 3.5 degrees above baseline. And as a consequence, human extinction will result not because we're not lacking in cleverness or adaptability. We're stunningly clever. We're stunningly adaptive. But we're going to run out of habitat. We're animals. We're human animals. Like other animals, we need habitat. And that habitat has got to include air and water and food and those fundaments that we take for granted. So that's where we're headed. I'll talk a little bit about that. We've had plenty of warnings. It was 1847 when George Perkins Marsh, American naturalist and ambassador, a combination you hardly ever hear of these days, concluded that the effects of burning fossil fuels will be profound with respect to the urban heat island effect and also to global climate change. This is 1847. We didn't really start burning fossil fuels. Most people don't even think that we began the Industrial Revolution until a few years after that, right? So we were just getting started at that point. Svante Arrhenius comes along half a century later and predicts a 1 degree temperature rise by the end, within 104 years. And he missed it by, oh, so little, stunningly. He thought it would be a good thing. Svante Arrhenius went on to win the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, and he thought climate change would be a good thing because he lived in a Nordic region, and he was looking forward to warmer temperatures and thought we'd be able to grow more food that way. But that aside, he predicted with stunning accuracy the consequences of burning fossil fuels on global average temperature. Frank Capra, yes, that Frank Capra, the filmmaker, when he was working for GE, produced a film called The Unchained Goddess, in which, quote, he says, we're not only dealing with forces of a far greater variety than even the atomic physicist encounters, but with life itself. He warned about human extinction in a film he made in 1958 as a result of climate change from burning fossil fuels. The Assistant Secretary of Justice in the government of Salvador Allende in Chile in early 1973, and there's a long quote here, and I've taken the liberty of translating the translation from his native language to English into fewer words. What he's saying here is industrial civilization is degrading, exhausting, and enslaving, and it threatens to cause human extinction. That's 1973. That was a long time ago. So we've had warnings for a long time. If you want to look at a more rooted, a more fundamentally scientific warning, the last time we had a below average temperature for any month was February 1985. Now think about it for a minute. About every other month, it should be slightly below average. The probability without climate change of any month being below average is about 50%. The odds of having this many months in a row of above average global temperature exceed the odds of plucking a single atom from the entire universe. Long odds. Robert Watson, testifying to Congress in 1986, says we can expect significant changes in climate in the next few decades, leading to human extinction. Thanks to Alec Jones, the somewhat unusual character journalist, for pointing this out. I discovered this just a few months ago, and Alex Jones was saying, see, it didn't happen. These guys are all loony. It's been a few decades. I'm not sure how he defines a few decades. It's only been 28 years, but I don't think we're at a few decades yet, apparently, by Watson's guess. And finally, the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases in 1990 reports that beyond 1 degree C may elicit rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses that could lead to extensive ecosystem damage. So 1 degree C is a significant threshold. And we've known this for a long time, 24 years now. In fact, James Hansen, the renowned climate scientist from the United States, finally, 2 months ago, concluded that his political target of 2 degrees C has been the wrong target the whole time. 1 degree C is what we need to worry about. I will argue that we've already crossed the Rubicon, that 1 degree C is irrelevant because we've triggered the kinds of consequences predicted by the United Nations Greenhouse Group in 1990. So we're at 0.85 above baseline right now, 0.85 degrees. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the renowned organization that won the Nobel Peace Prize for their work in 2007 with their fourth assessment, concludes we're headed for 1 degree C by 2100. Remember, the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases reports 24 years ago that beyond 1 degree C we're in serious trouble. Hadley Center for Meteorological Research comes along about a year later and says 2C is most likely. Bear in mind, as we work through these large-scale assessments done by these large, reputable organizations, that with each assessment, they have more data and they have more computational power. So Moore's Law indicates we double computing power in about 18 months. And so a year between assessments is actually quite a long time with respect to both computing power and the data at hand. United Nations Environment Program comes along in mid-2009, says 3.5 C by 2100. Remember, we haven't had humans on a planet 3.5 C warmer than baseline. Hadley Center for Meteorological Research comes along a year after the previous assessment and says 4 is the new 2 and it's coming by mid-century. This is huge. Global Carbon Project and Copenhagen Diagnosis, coincident with the COP15 meetings in Copenhagen, thrown under the bus by the Obama administration and their allies, concludes 6 or 7 degrees temperature increase by 2100. United Nations Environment Program comes along years ago now, says up to 5 C by 2050. A couple of things to keep in mind about these assessments, which now include more recently the United States Department of Defense in their quadrennial or every 4 year assessment, climate change is among the great security threats facing the United States. Something to keep in mind is none of these assessments take into account collapse of this set of living arrangements. None of them take into account any significant positive feedbacks either, or self-reinforcing feedback loops. And finally, the IPCC, with their fifth assessment, which is due out this year, but which has already been heavily leaked, concludes that global warming is irreversible without massive geoengineering of the atmosphere's chemistry. So they say we've already triggered so many self-reinforcing feedback loops, none of which are accounted for in this fifth assessment, none of which were accounted for in the fourth assessment either. The major feedback loops are not accounted for. But they say we've triggered those kinds of events, and we need to implement geoengineering. Let's think about geoengineering for a moment. Remember what they said, global warming is irreversible without massive geoengineering of the Earth's atmosphere. According to a paper in the Journal Literature that came out shortly thereafter, climate geoengineering cannot simply be used to undo global warming. So we need to implement geoengineering, according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They didn't indicate what kinds of geoengineering would be required, or they didn't even make suggestions. But according to a journal article that came out almost immediately thereafter, geoengineering probably isn't going to work. That's bolstered by another paper to come out the same month. Geoengineering may succeed in cooling the Earth, but it's also going to disrupt precipitation patterns to such an extent that it's a monster out of the box. We shouldn't go there. Piling on in the refereed journal literature from just last month, attempts to reverse the impacts of global warming by injecting reflective particles, which is the most commonly proposed geoengineering strategy, into the atmosphere, could actually make matters worse. And finally, from paper in Nature Climate Change, again last month, overall public evaluation of climate engineering is negative, so people aren't interested. It almost certainly won't work, and people are not interested. It's necessary, according to the incredibly conservative IPCC, but it won't work, and we're not interested in implementing it. So it appears that, in fact, we've triggered runaway greenhouse. Clive Hamilton points out in his latest book that without the sulfates associated with industry, when the age of industry is done, Earth will be an extra 1.1 C warmer within 3 days. We're at 0.85 C right now. That takes us to the political target of 2 C in a matter of days. And 2 C, as we know, triggers all kinds of nasty behavior in the climate that we don't want to have anything to do with. John Davies, writing for the Arctic Methane Emergency Group last September, says, quote, the world is probably at the start of a runaway greenhouse event which will end most human life on Earth before 2040. He's taking into account none of the self-reinforcing feedback loops I'm going to talk about. He's just considering carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which currently hovers at about 400 parts per million for the first time in the human experience. Good news, none of these include collapse of the set of living arrangements. Bad news, they don't include positive feedbacks, self-reinforcing feedback loops either. So all of these assessments are missing much of the story. If we think about those positive feedbacks for a minute, first of all, collapse leads to 1.1 C, which takes us to 2, 1.95, let's call it 2, 2 C above baseline in a week. Paul Beckwith, a climate scientist here in Ottawa, says that we could experience 6 degrees C increase within a decade. I can guarantee there will be no humans on a planet 6 degrees warmer than baseline. And we could be there in a decade. About a year later, he says up to a 16 C increase within a decade or two, based on his evaluation of historical evidence. When we talk about rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses, that's what we're looking at. Profound changes in a very short period of time. Climate change has gone well beyond linear. We cannot simply track the past and extrapolate that forward using a linear approach anymore. According to Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences paper from last October, Earth has seen a 5 C rise during a span of 13 years. 13 years, 5 C rise. So Beckwith's conclusions are not that far outside of what we have observed in the historical record. 60 in a decade, we've triggered all these self-reinforcing feedback loops that were not in place because of humans burning fossil fuels 55 million years ago. According to the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the game theory indicates current climate negotiations won't avert catastrophe, and I've actually been writing about this for a long time. Of course they won't. There is no politically viable approach to dealing with climate change. Do you think a politician is going to come up and say, we need growth, of course. Obviously we need growth. Growth for the sake of growth, the ideology of a cancer cell, we have to have that. That's what civilization is based on. Is some politician going to come up and say, well, instead of that, let's not do growth anymore. Let's do collapse. Because we need to reduce carbon emissions. The only way to reduce carbon emissions is to get into a Great Depression. Each year since 2008, the most dire year of the global economic depression in which we're still mired, each year since then, we've set a new record for CO2 emissions into the atmosphere. Every year we break the record from the year before, and we're in the midst of, to be polite, an economic recession at the world level. And from a paper in Science last August, climate change is on track to occur 10 times faster than any time in the last 65 million years. Of course it is. And remember, 55 million years ago, we observed a 5C rise in 13 years. 10 times faster than that? That sounds like a big number to me. According to Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the level of atmospheric carbon dioxide we observe today is the minimum level we'll see for at least the next 1,000 years. Carbon dioxide is incredibly recalcitrant in the atmosphere. We can't just wave a magic wand, start doing permaculture and powering down, and expect to reduce that number to 350 parts per million, as proposed by 350.org. It doesn't work that way. We're at 400 parts per million, roughly, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and we will be for at least the next 1,000 years. United Nations Environment Program points out that during 2008, global carbon emissions actually increased from the previous record-setting year. So this is the most dire year of the catastrophic Great Recession, as it's called, because we don't call them depressions anymore, because that's too depressing. So it was a Great Recession. I don't know about you, it was great for me. And during 2008, we set a record. We also broke that record in 2009. Then we broke that record in 2010. We broke that record in 2011. And guess what? We broke that record in 2012. What do you know? We just found out we broke that record in 2013. We're in the midst of a Great Recession, to be kind, and we set a record every year for carbon emissions. We can't just slow carbon dioxide emissions by even being in the midst of an economic recession. Instead, only collapse prevents runaway climate change. We've known this for many years. Tim Garrett's excellent paper in climatic change was rejected by several other journals first, and then finally, after he submitted in 2007, was published online in 2009, there was such an outcry from the civilized community that it was yanked immediately. It was still there in electronic form, but it wasn't printed in paper for a couple of years later, giving other climate science groups an opportunity to respond to the paper, but Garrett was not allowed to respond to their criticisms. So his paper was critiqued, but he wasn't allowed to respond. I'm not suggesting there's politics in science. I'm pointing out that it's blatant as hell. If instead of looking at our sensors, our fancy instruments by which we measure temperature, if instead we look at the plants, let's go where Henry David Thoreau methodically, systematically collected dates of first flowering events near Walden Pond for several years when he was living there. And let's return then to the 2000s, between 2005 and 2009, I believe, and collect the same sort of data. The plants are telling us that in that area where the instruments tell us we've experienced a 1 degree C temperature rise, approximately the same as the global temperature rise, the plants are telling us it's warmed 2.4 degrees there. And finally, from the Astrophysical Journal, Earth is within 1% of being uninhabitable. For the entire lifespan of the astrophysical community, astrophysicists assumed that Earth lay right in the middle of the habitable zone. That if we look at a sun, the size of our sun up there on top,
they thought that Earth was right in the middle of that green band. But in fact, Earth is on the inner edge of that green band. We're at the within 1% of being uninhabitable. Venus is not shown here. Mars is shown. Venus is approximately the same distance toward the sun from Earth as Earth is from Mars. Earth is just barely in the habitable zone. It wouldn't take much of a change in atmospheric chemistry to push Earth out of the habitable zone. And guess what? We haven't made slight changes in Earth's atmosphere. We've made profound changes in Earth's atmosphere. Before the Industrial Revolution, we were 280 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now we're at 400. Before the Industrial Revolution, we were at about 700 parts per billion methane. Parts per billion, a much smaller number. But methane is about 100 times more powerful a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide in the first 20 years. We're now routinely around 2,000 parts per billion or more methane in the atmosphere. Three times the global average before the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. We've made profound changes. The instrument record based on land sensors indicates that there's been a pause in warming since about 1998. And the deniers point to this very, very frequently as evidence that warming has slowed, has peaked out, has topped. But in fact, that heat has been accumulating, and as of March 2013, now we're a year later, the accumulation continues. The accumulation of heat on Earth has been going into the oceans. The oceans, of course, account for most of the mass of the planet. We've been measuring temperature on land for a long time, so that was really convenient that we kept collecting those records. And it was great that it plateaued. Starting in 1998, the temperature actually didn't change a lot, global average temperature, on land. But then we scratched a little deeper beneath the surface and found out that the Earth is still collecting a bunch of heat. It's just going a different place than we thought it was. It's going into the ocean. The oceans are warming dramatically. I want to talk about some of the self-reinforcing feedback loops that have been triggered. The first of those we found out about in the Referee Journal literature in March of 2010 in Science. This is the only one reported in the journal literature in 2010. And it's now become the best studied of these self-reinforcing feedback loops. We've triggered 30 of these now. 28 of them appear to be irreversible. I'm not going to go through all of them in much detail because you'd be scratching your eyes out. And more importantly to me, you'd be scratching my eyes out. Arctic ocean methane hydrates. These hydrates or clathrates are lattices encaging methane molecules on the shallow seafloor in the Arctic. And as the Arctic Ocean warms, they float up to the surface, the lattice breaks down, and the methane is released into the atmosphere. Again, methane is about 100 times more powerful a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide molecule for molecule in the relatively short term, 20 years or less. The amount of Arctic Ocean methane hydrates is equivalent to 1,000 to 10,000 gigatons of carbon compared to 226 gigatons burned as of March 2010. We've now burned over 250 gigatons of carbon. But still, this is a pretty big number. This is 4 to 40 times the magnitude of the fossil fuels we've burned so far. So releasing those methane hydrates, it's sometimes called the clathrate gun. Triggering the clathrate gun is potentially catastrophic. We've been studying this one for a long time now. A minor increase in temperature is sufficient to trigger a tremendous methane release. According to a paper in Nature, actually the authors of the paper in Nature, a 50 gigaton burp of methane is highly possible at any time. 50 gigatons is a big deal. That's, again, about a quarter, now about a fifth of the carbon equivalent we've burned so far since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. We've observed methane plumes up to 150 kilometers across in the Arctic. What this looks like is soda, ginger ale, bubbling out of the Arctic Ocean. So if you're on a, say, hypothetically, you were on a sailing ship in the Arctic Ocean, you'd be able to see the Arctic Ocean bubbling all around you as far as the eye could see. And that's methane coming up from beneath the seafloor. just looking at this feedback, Sam Carana predicts global average temperature more than 4C above baseline by 2030. Remember, we've never had humans on a planet at 3.5C above baseline, and more than 10C by 2040. And according to his colleague Malcolm Wright, the Gulf Stream transport rate started the methane hydrate or clathrate gun, fired the gun, in the Arctic in 2007, when its energy per year exceeded 10 million times the amount of energy per year necessary to dissociate subsea Arctic methane hydrates. So it appears that we fired the clathrate gun about 7 years ago. It's interesting, among the many, many, many people who criticize my work, was an interview a couple of weeks ago with a couple of colleagues of mine, and one of them says, we don't really know that we've fired the clathrate gun. I would argue that we can't know until about 10 years afterwards. He has no idea that it's been 7 years. He thinks we just found out last week. We didn't. 7 years, 10 years, I think we probably have enough evidence to say we've done some serious harm. If you look at a figure from last week, this is the methane concentration right now, global distribution of methane. And you can see the accumulation in the northern hemisphere in particular. And this is one of several reasons that the northern hemisphere is going to lose habitat for humans more rapidly than the southern hemisphere will. Another reason is that there is much more land relative to the amount of water in the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere. I mean, the southern hemisphere has South America, a third of Africa, and Australia. The northern hemisphere has all the big land masses, Europe, Asia, and North America. Right. So the land-to-water ratio is a big contributor to expected increases in temperature.
Professor Guy McPherson on the science behind our global warming catastrophe. We'll hear the rest of his talk next week. Thanks to Michael Welch, the Global Research News Hour, and radio station CKUW in Winnipeg, Canada, for the recording. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. Check out the free archive of all our shows at our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. We come to you weekly. That's W-E-E-K-L-Y. We come to you weekly from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, wishing you a good week, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again. Peace.